You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. No one alive in 1978 can ever forget the horror of seeing hundreds of bloated dead bodies lying in the Jonestown Guiana sun when the news broke of the mass suicide of members of the People's Temple. Horror matched only with incredulous wonder at how and why such an occurrence could have come to pass. The answers were never satisfying. Now, Jeff Gwynn, who previously wrote the definitive book on Charles Manson, has turned his attention to the Jonestown question with his new book, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Jeff Gwynn, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be back.
It wasn't just mass suicide, but I realized when I read your book, but really the murder of hundreds of other people.
See, that's the thing. What happened in Jonestown in November 1978 is something I think most people have decided was just a bunch of brainless followers doing what an obviously insane leader told them to do, and there was much more to the story than that. And no, it was mass murder. It was never mass suicide.
It's, one of the haunting things that struck me in your book was, you know, I do remember that scene so well, seeing it on the news around Thanksgiving time of all those bodies, and then reading in your book that that was just only the top layer.
Well, I was able in Guyana to find Colonel Desmond Roberts, who had led in the Guyanese Defense Force, the first outsiders to enter Jonestown the day after it had happened. And their first report was that about 400 people had died, but since they believed nearly 1,000 were living in Jonestown, they had no idea where the other 600 had gone. Now, Jonestown was cut out of dense jungle, and I promise you, until you've been there, you have no idea. My photographer and I had to cut our way in with machetes because it's so overgrown now. But where were these 600 people? That was the big question. So it was only the second day that they thought, wait, there's more bodies. And they looked under the first layer of bodies, and there was a second one. And the odd thing was that the top layer of bodies were mostly women and men of young adult to middle age, and the ones underneath them were old people. But still, there were at least 300, maybe 400 more people missing. And they looked, and there was a third and final layer, and that layer was the children of Jonestown, almost 300 of them. So the scene was even more horrible than was initially reported and that most people remember.
Jeff Gwynn, in your book about Manson, you uncovered a sort of logic, a criminal logic, I guess, that made some sense of the Manson family murders, the Tate-LaBianca killings. What about Jim Jones? Did you find any logic that allows us to understand how this thing, mass suicide and mass murder, took place?
I don't know that logic's the right word. People ask me when I started working on this book, well, did I think that Jim Jones was another Charles Manson? And my answer to that now is that comparing Manson to Jim Jones is like comparing Mickey Mouse to Machiavelli. Manson was just a blue-collar crook who in his heyday could only control a couple dozen drug-addled kids, and even then not for long. Jim Jones built over almost 25 years, really what you would have to call an empire, about 5,000 members of People's Temple in San Francisco, as many as 100,000 people around the country sending in contributions. But what Jim Jones did ultimately, with one exception that I hope we'll get to talk about sometime tonight, is he was the classic demagogue that we find all throughout history. All demagogues, no matter what political or religious stripe, have certain things in common. And Jim Jones fits the pattern brilliantly, perfectly, in all but one way. The first in that he announced himself to potential followers as the only one who can solve this problem, the only one who can lead you to safety. That's the first thing they all do. And then the second thing he did, and did very well incrementally, is he makes followers believe that everyone who is not part of their group is the enemy. Not that people can disagree with the philosophies or how you're doing things, but that anyone who disagrees is inherently evil and out to hurt you in any way possible. So, no logic, but yes, you incrementally make followers believe that first, they must follow you or they're doomed. Second, that everybody else is the enemy. And then, of course, the ultimate step for demagogues is they always lead their followers into some sort of terrible situation or even doom. That's what happened with People's Temple.
Okay, you said something that scared me. I remember in the election, the presidential election of 2016, people may remember, that one of the candidates said, "Only I can fix things." Do you remember?
Well, you know, that is the first sign that we ought to turn around and run the other way. Though I do want to make this one point. Talking about this book and talking about demagogues, some people have praised me and others have accused me of singling out Donald Trump. Trump is, at least in theory, a Republican conservative, but it's also important to remember Jim Jones was a great liberal, even a socialist. And that demagogues can come in any political or religious stripe. It just so happens that the one I'm writing about in this book was a liberal who avidly proclaimed himself at the end to be a socialist.
In your book, you make a point of saying that, as you were just saying a minute ago, that there's a big difference between Charles Manson and Jim Jones, and also of Adolf Hitler and Jim Jones, and those are two people to whom he is often compared. But there is some reason for comparison. I mean, for one thing, with Manson, he's now linked because Jeff Gwynn has written books about both Jim Jones and Charles Manson.
Well, what I really do is I write books about eras in American history, and I try to take some iconic individual event from those eras. With Manson, I was writing about the 1960s. And when I finished that book, I wanted to write about the 1970s, what happens in America next. And it occurred to me, in thinking of possible topics, that there's only two things from the 70s that everyone really remembers now. The first is Watergate. And I didn't see that I could write any book that would add anything to the 500 or so books on Watergate that are already out there. And the other thing we remember from the 70s is don't drink the Kool-Aid. That's become part of the lexicon. And it's taken to mean don't be an idiot, don't follow a leader who's clearly taking you down the wrong path. And that saying, that phrase, is truly one of the worst misrepresentations of an actual event that I can remember. It has no validity whatsoever, and I hope people reading the book get that sense that it isn't something we should be saying, not only because it isn't true, but because it's tremendously insulting and degrading to some very wonderful social-minded people who died in Jonestown not because they were brainless idiots, but because they had been tricked into being there by someone who took advantage of their real desire to bring about a better, more equitable world. The whole basis of People's Temple was there should be complete and equal respect for everyone, regardless of race, gender, how much you own, how much you don't. They weren't out to take over the world. They were trying to set an example of how everyone living together, working together, respecting each other, was a better way for the world to go. And so they died not out of stupidity or out of selfishness, but because they had wanted a better world for all of us.
Okay. And in the case of Adolf Hitler, I mean, one can't help but remember that when Hitler was launching his campaign against the Jewish people, he criminalized their behavior in a gradual way. That is, first he made it illegal for them to buy flowers and ride on a bus or purchase things at the grocery store and so on, until their behavior became criminal behavior and they became criminals. In the same way, Jim Jones first asked people to give their money and then their possessions and then their relationships with their family until finally it seemed like a logical next step to give their lives.
Well, demagogues do work incrementally. One point that absolutely floored me, and I found this out when I was investigating Jones's childhood and was finally able to talk to a cousin of his who grew up right down the street. They were close in age. You know, Jones's childhood family had never really talked before. They've always tried to keep quiet after this, but finally this one cousin was willing to talk. One of the things she told me is that even when Jim Jones is a young boy, World War II is going on, and all the other boys in this little Indiana farm town want to pretend to be Allied soldiers. You know, I'm General Patton, I'm General MacArthur. Jim Jones was struck by and admired Adolf Hitler. He did not then or ever buy into Hitler's repudiation of the Jews. Jones was very much against that type of thing involving someone's religious faith. But he was impressed, absolutely fascinated, by Hitler's ability to draw the attention of crowds and to have people respond to him in such a loud, sort of generous way. And when Hitler committed suicide, Jim Jones is thinking that is the right way, if you're about to be overwhelmed by your enemies, to go out. That shows your disdain. Take your own life and prevent them from being able to do what they wanted with you. So there's a certain seed sown when Jim Jones is 11, 12, 13 years old.
So he always saw suicide as an option.
Very much so, and during the 25-year run-up to November 1978, he would frequently discuss in his sermons with his ever-growing number of followers that if you really believed in social equality, you had to commit everything, and that wasn't just personal property. You had to be willing, if necessary, to commit your life. He would talk sometimes about Masada. You may remember the ancient Israeli story where Israeli rebels are cornered on a mountaintop fortress by the Roman army. And just before the Roman army can overrun them, the people of Masada, men, women, and children, all take their lives as a sign of disdain and ongoing rebellion. So what happened in November, though his followers didn't realize it, Jones had really been signaling all these years. To him, it was a logical culmination.
In addition to being influenced by Hitler, it seems to me that Jim Jones is influenced by Houdini. There was a lot of things. There were a lot of things that Houdini used to do when he first started. He was, and this is funny because he later tried to find all of the fake mediums in the world, but he pretended to be one, and he would come to a town and he would research all kinds of things about the people there so that he could make it seem as though he had uncanny knowledge of them. And then, of course, he would fake things in the same way that Jim Jones faked his healings.
Jones wasn't necessarily original in his thinking. We really need to think of him as a sort of sponge. Even as a child, you know, he grows up in this little tiny town in Indiana. There are five different churches in town. He joins them all. He would absorb what he thought was useful from each one. Another role model was Father Divine on the East Coast. You know, the minister who claimed that he was God on earth and wanted his followers to be completely self-sufficient, wanted to control every aspect of their lives. And when Jones needed followers that weren't people of color. He went out on the Midwest revivalist circuit and became famous as this great man who could somehow read minds and perform wonderful healings. And it was all a fraud. He used plants in the audience. I actually found some of these folks who described in great detail what Jones would do and fool eyewitnesses who were right there in the spot. If you or any of your audience have ever wondered how a faith healer can not only claim to remove a cancer from someone, but make it sort of magically appear, I would refer you to chapters 8 and 9. We actually do lay out how he did that.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Jeff Gwynn. He's the author of the national bestseller Manson, and his new book is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Many of the people who gave their lives in Jonestown knew full well that Jim Jones was a fake and a phony when it came to his healings. They participated, they helped him fake it, and yet they believed in him enough to take their lives.
See, this is the other part of People's Temple that I knew nothing about, and it just astonished me. Even at his worst, and of course by the end, Jim Jones was pretty terrible, People's Temple is still accomplishing great social things. The first early church in Indianapolis, Jim Jones and People's Temple are at the forefront of helping integrate one of the most segregated cities in America. And this is 10, 15 years before the civil rights legislation that made it mandatory. When they get out to California, they have all kinds of social programs in place. Everything from drug addiction clinics to marriage counseling, free food and clothing for anyone who needed it, no questions asked. They would even take ghetto kids, bright, promising ghetto kids who had no chance of ever getting out of their streets. And they sent them to college, full ride, books, tuition, dorm, meals, everything. So they're doing all these good things, and Jones makes it clear to the followers who are seeing through some of his acts that he's only doing what he has to bring members in, to get all kinds of donations and gifts from people around the country that make these programs possible. He would tell them that it was socialist pragmatism. So many people end up in the late 60s into the 70s, all the way into Jonestown in the Guyanese jungle, staying not because of Jim Jones, but in spite of him, because they realized he had leadership qualities that were bringing about some very special programs that helped those who were most in need.
And there were some people who, famous people, who lent their, you know, their name or their credence to Jim Jones, people like Rosalind Carter and Jane Fonda. They must have been very embarrassed later.
Well, some did it more deliberately than others. When Jim Jones proved in a San Francisco mayoral election that he and People's Temple could swing any close vote, politicians from both parties began trying to get his support. Rosalind Carter, while campaigning for her husband in 1976, was having an event in San Francisco, and they needed to sort of paper the house, bring in warm bodies. And here Jim Jones volunteers to bring in a mixed race audience to fill the place, just as long as he's allowed to sit on stage next to Mrs. Carter. She sends him an obligatory thank you note afterwards, and there's a follow-up phone call. But Jones is adept at making these simple courtesies seem like a close friendship, and he starts announcing in his sermons that if Jimmy Carter's elected president of the United States, he may name Jim Jones ambassador to Guyana. Walter Mondale, stopping on a quick campaign flight into San Francisco, briefly met with Jones on the tarmac and sent him a thank you note later saying it's so inspiring to see churches that go out to try to bring about social change. Jones shows that letter to the government of Guyana when he wants to move there in 1976, and says, look, the Vice President of the United States is a personal friend. So they weren't doing it deliberately. Some of the California politicians were. Jane Fonda, the actress, came to People's Temple and was so impressed she wrote Jones a sort of slobbering letter about how wonderful it was. Angela Davis, the black revolutionary in America in the 1960s. Laura Allende, the sister of the martyred president in Chile. So Jones knew how to bring these people in, and whether their support was sort of peripheral or extensive, he could still make hay with any of it and make it appear as though he had the absolute support of some of the most important people in the world.
Jeff Gwynn, talk a little bit about race. You know, I think we know that a number of the victims, if we want to call them that, were African American, although there were also a lot of white members of the People's Temple. And what was Jim Jones' attitude toward race that you uncovered in writing the book?
If there was any core, honest motivation on Jim Jones's part that isn't something bad, it's that from the time he was a child, he was deeply and personally committed to civil rights. He grew up in one of the whitest states of the Union, and one where the Klan had taken pretty wide hold after it was sort of chased out of the South for a while. But Jones happened to be born in Randolph County, Indiana, and that was where there were three small black enclaves that couldn't be called towns. They weren't big enough. But they sort of surrounded Jones's hometown of Lynn. So he grew up and was one of the few white children in the state who pretty much every day would have interaction with people of color. By the time he's a teenager, every Saturday he's putting on his good clothes and getting on the bus, and he's riding to the nearest big city, which was a town called Richmond. And he'd go down to the railroad tracks where the black indigents, the poor people of color, would be living. And he would preach that everyone is equal, racism is wrong, God loves us all, no matter what is our skin color. And there was nothing he could get out of it besides getting roughed up by white teenagers who didn't want to hear what he was saying. And that commitment was quite genuine in his ministry. Now, it's also true that later on, he's using these people to further his own ends of gaining power. But never in People's Temple itself was one race ever raised above another. Everyone was treated differently. Everyone was treated the same by Jones, and that includes right up to the moment of their death.
Well, yes, but at the same time, Jones had a lot of sexual relations with a lot of the temple members, but not so many of them were African American.
It was kind of funny. There's a wonderful, wonderful woman named Winnell Smart, who was a member of People's Temple and survived herself but lost her four children, her mother and her uncle, in November 1978 in Jonestown. And Winnell is not the kind of woman who will take garbage from anybody. And Jones always liked everyone to agree with everything he said, but in Los Angeles one night, Nell confronted him. She said, Jim, you say that all the races are equal, but all these people within the church you're having sex with are white. Why? And his explanation was that he uses sex sometimes to have to remind people of their position, kind of keep them in their place. And because black members didn't have the same egos as white members, he didn't have to have sex with black men and women as he did with white men and women. But by the time he's in Jonestown towards the end, he's also singling out some black women for sex.
He kind of goes through a very strange transformation in through the course of your book as he moves closer to the end. What role did drugs play in all that?
The drugs played a huge role. Jones was not, in my opinion, mentally ill. But he was a megalomaniac. He was paranoid. He certainly was a demagogue. And these tendencies can be greatly exaggerated by the use of drugs, particularly amphetamines. And Jim Jones abused those drugs. He took handfuls of uppers to keep himself going for 20 hours at a time, and then handfuls of tranquilizers so he could sleep for a bit. And quite often, he wasn't entirely coherent, but by then his sermons had gotten so rambling it was sometimes hard to tell. But the drugs certainly had their effect on him. So did the increase in power. The more public influence he got and the more control over the personal lives of his followers, the more he was determined to have. And again, it is typical of demagogues that when they reach a pinnacle of power, they also arrive at the point where they feel anything they say must be true, no matter how bizarre it may seem to anyone else, that the only facts that matter are the facts they personally believe in, and that anything that is good for them, legal or illegal, is good for all their followers because the demagogues believe that they personally are the cause, not the people who have given them the power. That's what happened with Jim Jones.
We're talking with Jeff Gwynn, and his new book is called The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Jeff Gwynn is also the author of the national bestseller, Manson. Well, during the course of the People's Temple's existence, Jones occasionally pretended to get everybody to commit suicide, if that's the right way. I mean, he kind of did drills, suicide drills or something of that nature. Did everybody believe on the day that they died that they were going to die that day?
Absolutely not. Again, as I would do my research, I found things that stunned me. In this particular case, it turned out that twice previously, before November 18th, 1978, Jim Jones told followers that they had drunk poison and they were going to die, the first time in San Francisco, the second time in Jonestown. And each time he would declare that some final emergency had occurred and that this would be the end. He was training them to be as paranoid as he was, to believe that outside forces, the U.S. government, the FBI, the CIA, hired mercenaries, at any time were going to come and attack in Jonestown and wipe out everyone there. So by having them take the poison, saying this is going to be a gesture, we're going to show our disdain, Jones explained that they were proving they were real socialists, they were really committed to justice, and that this would be their final message. Now, on both occasions, after telling people, okay, you drink this, and in 45 minutes you're going to be dead, most everybody drank, reluctantly. Then they didn't die, and Jones said to them, this was just a test. Now you've shown your loyalty, you're true socialists. So, in November 1978, when he calls everyone together to the pavilion in Jonestown and tells them this is it, and now this is what we have to do, many, many of the people there thought, oh, this is just Jim doing it again, bringing us to the brink and pulling us back.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. Jeff Gwynn is also the author of the national bestseller, Manson. Now, when the actual event took place in 1978, the momentous event that precipitated the actual suicide and murder was the murder of the congressman, Leo Ryan.
Right. Jones had literally been driven from the United States when a series of investigative articles in the Bay Area press, well, that were just well documented, everything was nailed down, began showing the darker side of People's Temple. Everything from members not being allowed to leave, to money in foreign accounts, to followers being beaten during services if it somehow displeased Jones. And Jones's power base in America, particularly in California, begins to erode, and he can't stand that. He's told his people that he's prepared a place in the promised land for them, the promised land being the jungles of Guyana and the northwest coast of South America. And in this dense jungle, a few dozen members of People's Temple called the Pioneers have begun trying to cut out a working farm. And the idea is that over a period of maybe 5 years, more and more members of People's Temple will move there until maybe 500 members ultimately live there. But Jones, in his haste to get the heck out of America while he still has a following, brings over 1,000 people, and they immediately move in and they're overcrowded. It's terrible. They have very little to eat, but they are there, Jim Jones tells them, to set the socialist example. We are going to prove for once and for all the way we do things is best. And he tells the people, if you want to leave, you can try. But there's 150 miles of jungle between you and civilization. You don't have any money, and I've taken your passports. But if you want to go, go ahead and try. Leo Ryan, in 1977 and through 1978, hears complaints from constituents that they believe they have family members being held against their will in Jonestown. Ryan decides in November, right after he's reelected, that he's going to go investigate, bringing with him some members of the Washington and San Francisco media and some members of the group calling themselves concerned relatives. He believes that Jones won't let him into Jonestown, and then he intends to return to the states and launch an official congressional investigation. Jones absolutely doesn't want Ryan in, but ultimately, grudgingly, allows him to come. And they enter Jonestown on Friday, November 17th, in the early afternoon. 24 hours later, Leo Ryan is convinced that Jim Jones is right and his accusers are wrong. Out of more than 900 people there, only 15 tell Leo Ryan, yes, I'd like to leave. And they are given money for transportation back to the States and their passports. And Ryan and the newsmen, concerned relatives, 15 people who Jones labels defectors, leave in a truck, driving through the jungle to an airstrip 6 miles away where planes will take them back to the capital city of Guyana. But Jones sends after them on a tractor armed men, and they catch up with them at the runway, and they open fire, and Ryan, 4 others are murdered, others fall grievously wounded, and these men, armed men, return to Jonestown to tell what they've done. Jones calls everyone together. The way he looks at it, if a congressman can come and take 15 people now, what's to stop another one showing up, and maybe he'll take 50? And all the people staying in Jonestown, because they believe at least in the purpose of People's Temple, if not Jones himself, if they see how easy it is to get away, then they'll want to go too. So here's where he tells them it's time for the final moment. That the congressman is dead. Jones claims he had nothing to do with it, which of course is one of his lies. But now it's inevitable. Any time the government is going to just come in here and kill us all and drag our children away and do horrible things, we need to make a revolutionary act. He tells them this won't be suicide. It's just going to be a measure of disdain. And that's when they bring out the vat, not of Kool-Aid, but a cheap knockoff called Flavor-Aid, mixed with cyanide and tranquilizers.
And did people think it was fake?
A lot of people did. Jones begins, and he had a tape recorder running. If any of your listeners really want to hear some of this, You can find the so-called Jonestown death tape on the internet and listen to it. He tells them that you just sip a little and it's like going to sleep. You'll step quietly over to the other side, and he thinks they should start with the children. And you take these infants in arms, they're brought up to the front by parents who really believe that they're doing something merciful for their kids, that if they don't do this now and provide an easy death, that the U.S. government is coming in any time and the kids will suffer. And they drip the poison into the children's mouths through syringes. But then something happens. Everybody's watching, expecting it to be peaceful like Jones promised. But cyanide poisoning is one of the most painful ways to die. It restricts the body's ability to take in oxygen. So you go into convulsions, you froth at the mouth. Finally you suffocate, but it's a horrible death. And so the children, these babies, start writhing. They're going into the convulsions. And you can hear Jones shouting on the tape, "No, they're not crying because it's painful. It's just a little bitter tasting. But now people are wondering." And on the tape you can hear there's maybe out of over 900, 100 people or so who believe totally in Jim Jones. And if he tells them to do this, they're going to. Then there's all the children, 300, and they have no choice. Neither really do the 200 old people. If they don't take the poison and everyone else dies, they won't last a day in the deep jungle. There are people there who are fed up with Jim Jones, who absolutely don't believe a word he's saying. But if the congressman's dead, they do share his paranoia. More soldiers are coming. It's better to do it yourself than let them murder you. And finally, we know this. It's incontrovertible. I've seen the autopsies that done by the doctors in Guyana who first found the bodies. At least four dozen, maybe as many as 200 people, refused to take the poison. But Jones has armed guards surrounding them. If they won't take it voluntarily, they are held down and injected with the poison. And you can tell because their bodies had special abscesses on them where the needle had punctured their skin. And so, finally, everyone in Jonestown dies, but it was never everyone meekly lining up like sheep to the slaughter. It was mass murder.
So at least, you know, we're saying 300 children and a couple more hundred people held down.
Right.
That's a lot of people. And it's, you know, and babies and little children. It's just, it's so horrifying.
It's horrifying almost beyond belief. And the soldiers who came and were the first ones on the scene, some of them ran screaming into the jungle. A couple days later, when the U.S. military arrived to try to get the bodies into coffins and transport them back to the States, the first thing they had to do was call Washington and ask for a shipment of snow shovels, because that was the only way they could get the bodies on the bottom layers off the ground.
How horrible.
Yes.
So, unfortunately, it wasn't the very last time that something like this happened. It was never as big or as mass a number of people, but what about David Koresh, or what about those people that castrated themselves and waited for the space men to come?
See, here's a difference between Jonestown, People's Temple, and Koresh and some of the others. People's Temple never felt that their deaths were fulfilling some biblical prophecy, that it was bringing about the end of days, and that's something they thought in Waco, and that's why they welcomed in Waco the soldiers coming in, the shots being fired. They were actually eager for that because that was going to bring about what their leader had prophesied. People's Temple never was intended to overthrow a government by any means. It wasn't intended to force others to accept People's Temple's beliefs. What it was meant to do was to be an example of mutual respect, of eliminating race and money as the means by which we evaluate and treat other people. And so at the end, when these people are dying, some by choice, some really, I think we can call it by violence, they are dying not because they think it's biblically foretold. They're not dying because they're willing to go necessarily. They're dying because up to this last moment they've sacrificed so much, they've given up everything they had, and they're in this dense, hellish place, and they truly believe that at any moment the United States Army is coming in to murder them and do awful things to their children. So it was not an act that was in any way religiously motivated. It was entirely different thing. I'm not saying the other events are not tragic. They are. But this was not a willful sort of step into oblivion in any sense.
Jeff Gwynn, you've written this book about Jim Jones and the People's Temple. You've written about Charles Manson, Bonnie and Clyde, the shootout at the OK Corral. And you've also written some fiction, westerns, like Glorious and your new book, Silver City. Is there an element that ties all of your work together?
In all my work, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, I ultimately think what I'm trying to do is emphasize the difference between real history and mythology. You know, the cowboy books that are just shoot 'em up westerns, you know, it wasn't really that way. And with Jim Jones and People's Temple, I think most of us, I include myself in this, have completely misunderstood what happened. And after devoting 3 years of my life to studying everything I can find out about it, going everywhere Jones went, trying to locate everyone still living that he had encountered so I could talk to them and get their viewpoints, I really believe that it's time we absolutely need to re-examine Jim Jones, Jonestown, People's Temple, because there's a tremendous lesson we need to learn about demagogues, what they do and what happens when they do it. With demagogues continue to be with us, when are we going to learn? And Jones provides a classic example. We can look at what happened there, and it's impossible, if you understand that, not to be scared as hell about some things that are going on now.
Okay, I'm scared, but how do I stop him?
What we have to do is we have to identify the elements of someone who is a demagogue, and then move away. There are clues. We talked about it. Jones always claimed he was the only one who could be the right leader. He always claimed everyone else is the enemy. He asked everyone to believe him and no one else. And, of course, he wanted followers gradually to give up control of their own lives, to cede it over to him. And when that happened and they end up out in the jungle, there seems to be no choice. In terms of religious demagogues, we have to step away from whatever factions that they're trying to establish. In terms of political demagogues, we have the ballot box. If more people understand what they're seeing and what these supposed leaders are doing, we have the votes. We can change it.
All right. Well, if Donald Trump is a demagogue, you know, it was spelled out pretty clearly before the election, and yet he's President Donald Trump now.
Anyone can get elected by making impossible promises that people are willing to believe. Willing acceptance of disbelief is something, it's a psychological phrase. What we have to ask ourselves, and if we voted for such people, once they're in power, are they doing the things they said they would do? If they aren't, why aren't they? You know, that it's okay to be skeptical. Does that make sense?
Yes, but in the environment that we have in America now, where we have this division of Democrats and Republicans, and each side feels that giving an inch to the other side is losing power for themselves, it's fertile ground for a demagogue.
And demagogues always flourish in times of national schisms. I mean, you know, if you just want to look at the last book, Charlie Manson took great advantage of the race riots and the total disagreement over the war in Vietnam. We're in one of those times now. We lived through it. We came together. There will be leaders emerging, there have to be, who talk more reasonably, who are willing to meet in the middle. And the way that happens is the people who vote have to be willing to do that. When the national disgust becomes prevalent enough, then comes change. I think if we recognize demagogues better, if we're more aware, then maybe this can happen to us less often.
This book is called The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. The author is my guest, Jeff Gwynn. Jeff, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
I always like talking to you, Gary. Thanks for this opportunity.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and the People's Temple. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.